Very good to meet you finally, Alex. Very good.
Likewise, I'm delighted to be here. And I've never heard any Cézanne letters read aloud before. And these were read very well, I think. And give some clue, I think.
As to the man. So can you say a bit something about your choice of those two particular letters?
Those letters?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the first one was to a man called Choquet. And as you heard, it was written after Choquet had congratulated Cézanne on getting married. We should note that this happened comparatively late in life. Cézanne was already then in his late 40s before he got married, although he'd been with the woman in question for some time, and they had a son, as you also heard. Choquet was a collector. Not a rich person, but in fact a customs official. His wife had money, but Choquet had rather little. But he had a tremendous sensibility and drive and taste and an ability to make friends. And what Cézanne said in his letter about Delacroix acting as an intermediary between them. Cézanne says, Delacroix brought us together. What he means is that Choquet began by collecting Delacroix. Already a fine thing to do. And amassed goodness knows how many Delacroix. And Cézanne's favourite artist of the previous generation was Delacroix. If we ask who Cézanne revered in the recent past, it was Delacroix. And so when he happened on Choquet, and he found not only that Choquet was interested in Cézanne, but Choquet was interested in Delacroix, they had the makings of a wonderful friendship. And there's a marvellous image that somebody purveys of them at Choquet's house, on all fours, the two of them, looking at various Delacroix drawings and prints on the floor. Isn't that a wonderful image? But the letter, I think, is absolutely wonderful because it is, I think, tremendously poignant and typically of Cézanne. It's hard to get to the bottom of it. He talks, if you remember, about not having Choquet's stability, not having Choquet's stable temperament. And so already we see a very characteristic aspect of Cézanne, measuring himself against others whom he admired. I guess we all do this to some extent. But Cézanne did it in a big way. He tried to identify moral models and see how he measured up. So that's very interesting, I think. And then Cézanne says, if you remember, something about he had a few vines, but they withered. Now, this is a man who's just got married. He should be really happy. This letter is, at best, ambiguous about just exactly how happy he's feeling at this juncture. So there's a certain ambiguity, I think, which is characteristic. And finally, perhaps in that letter, this absolute commitment to his vocation. I'm still painting, he says to Choquet, rather as if he would be doing anything else. And ventures that nobody has yet done justice to the country where he is. He's speaking from Aix en Provence, his home, where he was almost literally embedded. Something about which I might say a bit more later on. So that's the first letter to his patron, friend, supporter, a very rare thing in Cézanne's life. Choquet was one of the people, one of the very few people in Cézanne's life that Cézanne would have called a moral support. He looked all his life for moral supports and tried to identify people who would be his moral supports. And Choquet was one. Should I say something about the second letter?
Well, I was just thinking of the other thing that comes to mind. You know, you write about this lovely, there's a lovely story in there about Choquet buying the three bathers, I think. And anyway, you might tell the story of Renoir.
Yes. When Choquet got going on collecting Cézanne, we're talking the 1870s, when Impressionism was still new, when what Cézanne was doing, which was some way beyond Impressionism already, was even newer and weirder and harder to swallow. In other words, Cézanne was not to everyone's taste by any means. Cézanne could hardly get exhibited, he could hardly get collected, he could hardly give paintings away for decades. A remarkable thing. Choquet began collecting him. Choquet bought a little bathers, if some of you will be able to picture Cézanne's rather clod-hopping bathers. And Choquet was absolutely thrilled with it, but he had the uncomfortable feeling that Madame Choquet would not be quite so thrilled with it. So this was rather awkward, you understand. And so he cooked up a scheme with, was it Renoir?
I think it was Renoir, yeah.
Where Renoir would say that he, Renoir, had bought it, and that they'd stick to this fiction for a while so that Madame Choquet could get used to the idea that maybe a little Cézanne could be interpolated between the one Delacroix and another. Mm. And they maintained this fiction for quite a long time until finally Renoir told all to Madame Choquet, who was not thrilled. It's noticeable that there are about six paintings of Choquet by Cézanne, portraits, but none of Madame.
And the other letter to his son, Paul?
Well, the other letter, yes, is one of his very last letters. It dates from 1906, which was in fact the last year of his life. This is a very, very late letter. It is, I think, the last letter that he ever wrote to his son, the last of an absolutely beautiful series of letters. Do read some of Cézanne's letters, and if you read some, read the letters, the late letters to his son. They're absolutely wonderful. And that letter is a good sample of them, I think. It seems to me a little bit Samuel Beckett-like. Finally, there is something. Is there something or is there nothing? There is finally something, says Cézanne. And there's this marvellous mixture, I think, of the brushes, the cocoa, the person who's copying him, who isn't too great a threat after all, the weather, the provinces, all my compatriots are arseholes beside me. There was something at the end then. I think we can take from this that very late in his life, when he's in his late 60s, Cézanne knew that he was onto something. This is a man who set out consciously to paint as no one had ever painted before. And succeeded. And I think that he realized that he had managed to do something that none of his peers had managed to do. Not Monet, not Renoir, not Pizarro, not Degas. All these men collected Cézanne and tried to figure out how he did it. And he knew that. And he knew they were arseholes. which is not altogether fair, because he was friends with Monet. He painted side by side with Renoir. He knew all these people. Pizarro was his greatest painter friend. Again, we might come back to that, perhaps. Yeah, so it's not to be taken completely straight. And yet, it is to be taken somewhat straight. But there is a postscript. Can I remember the postscript? Over the page, he says something to the effect that I think that the young are much more intelligent than the older people. There is a... Yes?
Yeah. The old can only see me as a disastrous rival. I think the young painters are much more intelligent than the others.
Yes. The old can only see me as a disastrous rival. Isn't that marvellous? The young painters are the people to rely upon. And this too is very interesting, I think. It contradicts the whole of the myth about Cézanne being unapproachable, uninterested, almost sort of sociopathic in his avoidance of people. This is not true. He encouraged the young, I think, and would even encourage them to come out into the countryside with him. So there's a note here at the end also about what we can hope for from the younger generation, and, by the way, what we can't from the older.
I'd forgotten that. So I want to talk more about Cézanne as we go on. Perhaps we'll have to be careful not to just... Anyway. But I wanted to also introduce you, Alex. You know, you're a professor of international relations. So first of all, what is that? I mean, I vaguely know what the word international and relations mean. But how does one become a professor of them? And then how did a professor of international relations end up writing a biography of Cézanne?
This is dangerously close to what is the metaphysical basis.
It is. The evening started in that vein, so I thought...
Yes. Well, international relations, let's see. I'll give you an abbreviated version. It's a new subject, really. It started after the First World War, and it was driven by the idea of somehow helping us to prevent further wars. So you see that it's a discipline that has already failed catastrophically in its purpose, and yet surely that impulse is a good one. And the idea was for people to learn about war and peace and international security and how the world works. So it's really a sort of congeri mix of various other disciplines that go to make international relations. There's some history, there's some politics, there's some economics, there's some philosophy, and so it goes. And I rather like about it, it's heterodox mix. It attracts people then from various other locations. And it tends to be, of course, a kind of international endeavour in itself, which is also, I think, a good thing. I teach at St. Andrews at the moment, and in typical seminar groups there would be a very cosmopolitan mix. And I take it that's a good thing, too. So I began myself by studying modern history with an admixture of economics, and then doing further study in war studies at, as they call it, at King's College London, and sort of segued into it from that direction. And I began writing about the sort of people that people often write about when they study international relations, which is to say diplomats, military figures, and so on. Often writing biographically. It seemed to me that we still undervalue the biographical approach in academic life. Many academics are prone to look down on biography, rather, seeing it as a rather simple-minded endeavour. You know, people are born, they live a while, and then they die. This is a rather easy story to tell. There's some of that. Not always, of course. But I came increasingly to feel that dealing with the usual suspects, if you like, military figures, diplomatic figures, the people on the official international stage, leaves something crucial out of account. And it's very closely related to one or two of the things you were saying in your introduction, I think. It seems to me that in what we might call Anglo-American culture, loosely, artists of various kinds are often rather marginalised or ghettoised, meaning I think we often tend to treat painters as daubers of paint and not as thinkers or intellectuals or people who can shape or reshape a world. Or musicians, as you know, tinklers of keys, and not as animating intelligences, etc. So it seemed to me that art of various kinds can take us to places that other things cannot take us to. And I think that's a feeling that's very widely shared. But it's extremely difficult to demonstrate, or specify, or prove. So this was one of the things that impelled me to move from generals and so on to artists, and to try to treat artists in much the same way as I'd been treating generals and diplomats. To treat them as major historical figures. In one sense, then, to normalise them. I mean, of course, to try to take the measure of them as artists, what they were trying to do, what they said they were trying to do, and so on, but to weigh them, if you like, against other world shakers. So a Cézanne seems to me to be almost a kind of paradigm case. Cézanne, I think, is as important for showing us a new world, in some ways a new self, as Marx or Nietzsche or Freud. The world looks different after Cézanne, as perhaps we can try and unfold this evening. So it's the impetus then is to give them their full measure as world historical figures, in a way that I think is often not done.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were talking, weren't we, beforehand, that Cézanne is the best read of the Impressionists, and but people haven't seen, until we get to your biography, haven't really taken that terribly seriously, as if painting, as you say, is just daubing paint, and there's no thinking involved. And yet Cézanne seemed to me to be a very philosophical painter. I don't know whether that's your sense.
Well, I think, yes, it is. It is indeed. I think he was clearly tremendously intelligent. He was very well educated. He's probably the best educated and most intelligent major painter of his generation. This is a man who reads Latin and Greek in his spare time for enjoyment, translates Virgil, reads the whole span of classical and modern French literature, who's best friends with Zola, famously, who knows half of Baudelaire by heart, who is incredibly learned. And we find that nobody had really tracked even his reading before. For a man who's supposed to paint it all the time, this man did a tremendous amount of reading, often getting up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And reading. Reading, 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 and then painting, painting, painting. So there's a tremendously well-stocked
intellect
yeah, here. Yeah, and I think there is a sort of philosophical streak, as witness bits of those letters, perhaps. So to take his measure, his intellectual measure, is not easy, I think. And it seems to me that a lot of people have failed there. Mm. Some of his contemporaries, because it wasn't always easy to understand whether when he was joking and when he was being serious. Mm. He was often ironic in a way that we would understand the term now. Very modern, in other words. Mm. He could speak different languages. So he came from Aix-en-Provence in the south. He spoke Provençal to people in Provence. Mm. When he went to Paris, he spoke high society French. Mm. I mean, almost literally different languages. Mm. Mm. There's a marvellous story of when he goes to a cafe where which was the kind of headquarters of Manet. Mm. Shall I venture this?
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Manet, the artist to beat of a slightly older generation. A formidable painter and presence. So Cézanne goes to the cafe where Manet and his band hang out. Cézanne is wearing his painting clothes, which is not the thing to wear. He hitches up his trousers as he comes in. He shakes hands all round, as you do. And finally he gets to Manet, the capo di tutti capi, if you like. And he says, bonjour, Monsieur Manet. I won't shake your hand. I haven't washed for a week. And he says this loud enough to be heard by the assembled gathering. Now, some people take this literally, which is exactly what he's playing on. But this, of course, is Cézanne's little joke, at Manet's expense. This is what I mean by
the sophistication and
yes,
the vanity.
Yes, the epitome of sophistication.
Yeah, yeah.
Who probably would not have cared to shake his hand,
right,
and must have been looking, you know, a little. it's a marvellous vision.
It's interesting. That reminds me. You contrast Pizarro's portrait of Cézanne, which is incredibly unpretentious, isn't it, with Manet's portrait of Zola. It was slightly a similar ring to that.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know why I've said that, but anyway.
Well, Pizarro was probably Cézanne's best artist friend, and understood him very well, I think.
Mm.
There's a genuine sympathy there, which comes out in the portrait that you mentioned,
yes,
I believe.
Right. And they seem to, Pizarro seemed to be very, very kind to. Cézanne,
yes,
from what you can see.
Slightly older, slightly more advanced when they were both youngish, almost a mentor to Cézanne at various stages. And then it becomes especially interesting later on because Pizarro was Jewish and France was convulsed by the Dreyfus affair that many of you will know about, which is where a Jewish army officer was accused of treason or treachery, framed, in fact, and the nation divided, really, between those who supported Dreyfus and those who were against. It was a kind of even more virulent expression of the kind of thing we've just seen in a referendum here. But this had tremendously poisonous consequences. Those who were against Dreyfus were often virulently anti-Semitic. And that spilled over into the whole of French society, such that Renoir, for example, Degas, for example, who had known Pizarro for 30 years, as intimate colleagues, cut him dead in the street and took to calling him the Jew Pizarro. This is what life had come to be in France at the turn of the century. Cézanne was on the wrong side of the Dreyfus affair. He was not a supporter of Dreyfus, but he was not a bigoted anti-Semite. There is a marvellous example of his personal humanity, where in an exhibition in Aix, he has himself recorded in the catalogue as a pupil of Pizarro. Mm. A public declaration of solidarity with the Jew Pizarro, repeated immediately after Pizarro's death, even. The posthumous declaration of solidarity. No other major painter was prepared to do that in his time. Again, an example of it not being simple to sort out Cézanne's thinking and allegiances. He was ostensibly, in some ways, rather conservative, and actually, in other ways, tremendously bold and radical.
I want to just come back to the biography again, because one of the things, I mean, obviously the first question that I had, you know, when I first thought about it again, is why another biography of Cézanne? I can think of another three, at least. And you're quite critical of some of the other biographies, particularly John Rewald's studies. And what you seem to have done is wanted to put Cézanne, because in a way he didn't have a very, you know, there's not much to say about him. In a certain sense, he worked.
And, yes.
He kept on saying in the letters, there's only work. There's work to bring us to our senses and so on. But you seem to have placed him and his emotional life and his moral life at the centre of the biography. Is that why you wanted to write a biography of Cézanne?
That's a big part of it, yes. I thought that... There are a ton of books on Cézanne, yes, and also it is, on the face of it, a rather unpromising life. Loads of people said to me that, it's boring. Why write about Cézanne? All he ever does is go out and paint. To which the answer is, of course, anybody who paints like that must have interesting things going on in here. And it seemed to me that we had not really begun to get to the bottom of what was going on in here, which is, of course, extremely difficult. So there was that. But I came to him via Braque, as you mentioned, in the sense, at least, that I did Braque first. And I found that when studying Braque, who was the next generation, Braque is an example of a man and a painter who did not lightly venerate people. Braque walked by himself, cat-like. He didn't have heroes. He thought that was flaky. Braque was a war hero himself on the Western Front. It's a very telling aspect of his life. Braque had no fear and no favour, if you like. But there was one exception. He revered Cézanne. Not only the work, but the life. What he knew, what he thought he knew of the life, this heroic struggle to paint new, to find a new world, that was heroic. And I found that wherever I looked then, all manner of interesting people felt the same way about Cézanne. So did Picasso, so did Matisse. If we were to array up here the main people of the next generation, Braque, Picasso, Matisse, Clay, Giacometti, all of them would say, in answer to the question, who is the greatest modern painter? Cézanne, unquestionably. There's something going on here, and it's going on beyond painting.
Well, you also bring in people like Heidegger later on, and
yes,
Allen Ginsberg, and
yes,
Wallace Stevens,
yes, philosophers,
yes,
poets, writers. Rilke, the young Rilke, goes to the first posthumous Cézanne retrospective in 1907 in Paris, the year after he died. 56 Cézannes, more Cézannes than anyone had ever seen. Rilke goes every day. Imagine, you go to the Tate every day, and you then write to your partner about it. Rilke's letters on Cézanne from that exhibition, still, I regret to say, the best book ever written on Cézanne. So, in other words, there's something about the Cézanne phenomenon that is wider than the Cézanne paintings, that is something about the man, the human being.
That's right.
That, got under people's skin, and got under the skin of so many fascinating people. Beckett, trying to figure out how to be Beckett, goes on a kind of European Cézanne hunt, trying to track down Cézannes, and trying to find out more about the master. So I wanted to try it somehow to investigate this. What was it? And to try then also to take the measure of the afterlife. Because it seems to me to be a very interesting case of somebody whose life is, as it were, extended after death.
Yeah.
So he dies in 1906. He's then recognised by his peers as extraordinary. But by and large, no one else has heard of him. A century on, 2006, and a little bit more, he's up there in the pantheon, isn't he? With Vermeer, with whoever. So in a very short period of time, historically, 100 years or thereabouts, something has happened to catapult him from being a kind of painter's painter, collected by painters, to being stratospheric. Cézanne is everywhere. So that too is very interesting, I think. It's always puzzled me why biographies or biographers stop at the death.
When they have such a great afterlife.
Yes.
Yeah. And we need to sort of start to wind this to a close, but, you know, I'm still sort of puzzled. We've been talking before, and it was Cézanne when I went to art school that, you know, I remember my tutor sending me off to look at Cézanne. And, you know, one of the things that Rilke says, isn't he? He says, and all I could see were the Cézannes. And I had that experience, you know. I went eventually to look at them in Paris, and all I could see were the Cézannes. It seems, and it sort of inspired a kind of devotion in me. And I remember my tutor feeling very much the same. So you can't help wondering, so what... How does Cézanne help us now? You know, what is his relevance now? Like I was talking just to Nico the other day, and we were saying, you know, he comes from an acting and a theatre background, and a theatre student would still be reading Shakespeare, they'd still be reading Chekhov and so on. I wonder whether art students are still looking at Cézanne, are still reading Cézanne. And yet so many people sort of still venerate Cézanne. It does feel like a veneration, not just a valuing of their work, but something like a veneration. And, you know, have you any more thoughts about why that is? And how can Cézanne sort of help us in a way? There's a sense in which I want to think he can.
I
don't know whether that's a question or just a sort of ramble, but...
Yes. Well, I think he is studied. I think that continues, that process.
Yeah, yeah.
People keep being struck, or stricken, if you like. It keeps happening. It happens a lot if you go, for instance, to Aix. I don't know whether any of you have had this experience, but if you get the chance to go to Aix-en-Provence, you can visit his last studio, which is preserved more or less as is, or rather as was, even down to some plausible-looking decaying fruit. but it's a marvellous place. And there are other places that I might say something a little bit about later on. So I think that there is some kind of passing on of the feeling. Whence it comes, or what he can communicate to us, is extremely difficult to answer, isn't it? I suppose that there's something about it being, for me, and I think for lots of the other people I mentioned, an absolutely exemplary life.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, morally exemplary. I think he thought of painting as an expression of a moral life. Meaning, perhaps, that he would give value to any given thing, regardless of status or genre or position or monetary value. An apple is as good as a king. That's part of the ethic, I think.
Yes.
And beyond that, I think he acts as a kind of demonstration to us about what a human being can do, or if you prefer, can be. None of this was easy. He was not a precocious talent in the way that a Picasso was a precocious talent. Picasso almost falls out of his cradle and can knock off a masterpiece in an hour. No, 5 minutes. And then another five. There are people who can, it seems, do things like that. Rarely, but there are. Cézanne was not one of those. This was a question of a struggle.
I mean, some of the epic struggle. Quite bad, aren't they, really?
Yes.
You know, bad by almost any judgment. And the judge, there's lots of questions about the drawing.
Yes. I think he was not nearly as bad as some people tried to make out. Nor as lunatic.
Right, yeah.
But certainly it's sort of untutored, if you like. So I think it's something about the example and something about his, the nature of the ambition. It's not simply to be a great painter. It's to do justice to what he sees and feels. And in the doing justice, somehow to get under the skin of things and show us things that we've not seen before. This is an epic ambition. That is not the sort of ambition that Michael Gove talks about. You know, it's the polar opposite of that. It's something very profound and far-reaching, I think. And I think it's part of the sense of that that is the reason why the Becketts and the Heideggers and the Rilkes latch onto him. Because they feel that there is something at work there that they should, if they possibly can, try to understand and emulate. He is the exemplary artist creator of the modern world. There's no question.
And that's a great place to finish. Thank you very much.